Hello, and welcome to Cruising Through History. My name is Xander. I'm sitting here with Scott Cruz, as always. Scott, where are we cruising through today?
Well, today, Xander, I thought I would talk about alchemy.
So, alchemy, this type of thing that's like metal to gold side of kind
yes.
of thing. Okay.
Yes, when we were talking about dragons last time, one of the symbols for alchemy was a dragon.
Okay.
And so it made me think, it kind of ties together. It's sort of something they would call, at the time it was called natural philosophy. It was a branch of that. And it was called proto-scientific. It could be pseudo-scientific, as we'll discuss in a little bit. But they sort of called it that. And actually, there were three centers of alchemy. China, India, well, actually four, the Islamic world. And then in Europe, it started what was called Greco-Egyptian alchemy. And then with the fall of the Roman Empire, a lot of that knowledge moved west or east. And in the Islamic world, when they started translating Greek texts like from Aristotle and Plato and things of that nature, they started translating those into Arabic, and then they started using some of that Greek science. And then it sort of came back to the West from the Islamic world back to the like medieval Europe.
So what is alchemy? Because it's not we know that, you know, it's not science. You're going to talk about it being a pseudoscience of some sort, but we know that it definitely was a thing. And it wasn't a scientific thing, but was a thing that spread
right.
And it was considered knowledge. It was a knowledge of sorts to
it was,
spread like that. So what is it?
It was sort of considered esoteric knowledge.
Okay.
In fact, many alchemists, and this is why it's hard for historians, because historians of science now are researching alchemy because it does have ties to chemistry and medicine and some of the developments from there. But what they're finding is sometimes it's hard because a lot of alchemists, and this sort of, it's really weird because even though there were these four areas of alchemy, there doesn't seem to be any tie between any of them. But
huh.
They all sort of had the same how they would do it, and a lot of the writing was intentionally opaque. It was written in symbols and all this stuff, so it's hard for people to decipher that now, because it was sort of known as, you know, I think they were trying to, you know, ancient wisdom, if you will, and one of the biggest things was the Philosopher's Stone. And we know this from, of course, there's a Harry Potter book.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, we were talking about Harry Potter about dragons, but in Harry Potter, there's a lot of alchemy, too.
Yeah. I think they have a class that's alchemy or something like
right.
that.
Right. That's where you get those substances and, you know, transmuting to this and that. And so the Philosopher's Stone was sort of like the magnum opus of alchemy in the West. It was, if you had this thing, you could do all kinds of different stuff. And one was the transmutation of base metals into noble metals. And of course, noble metals is gold. And what happened was, I think it was just, they were in the Greco-Egyptian alchemy, they would apply substances and they noticed sometimes they would change color. So later on, someone thought, if you can change color of a substance, why can't you just change the substance?
Okay.
Because sometimes mercury and sulfur were big elements in alchemy. And so if you applied this to something and turned yellow, you'd think, I wonder if we could change the whole thing and just make it gold.
So it's like a precursor to modern chemistry, but it's like a vague explanation. Like they're trying to philosophize the chemical reactions that are happening, but they don't actually know what's going on. And so they're like, here's what we think.
Right. In fact, and it's funny because in the West, it was the sort of the pursuit of this Philosopher's Stone to turn things into gold or what have you, even turn things into silver.
So the Philosopher's Stone here, it's essentially something that's like, it skips through processes to make something happen. Like the
yes.
rules don't apply.
Yes, it's funny because I kept getting kind of confused because they call it a stone. It's not really a stone. It's, I think it's an element that can It's something you can use to do these things. But it's like, you know, you can use it for this, you can use it for that. It almost becomes a panacea for a bunch of things.
Yeah, it's like the skeleton key of what transformations or transmutations is the word you use.
Yes, that's very good. And that's a good way of putting it. So, but it's interesting because as we're in the, we're talking about the difference between like Western dragons and Chinese dragons, Chinese alchemy is different. It sort of, it's more focused on medicine. And looking, and their philosopher's stone was the grand elixir of immortality.
Oh, you know, I've heard of something that's like a grand elixir. Can you tell me more about it?
Well, I think it was something they thought that they could create using whatever various mixtures to give you immortal, you know, immortality, you know, life forever, I guess.
It's almost like the like a fountain of youth, but you make it.
Yes. And actually, they think that's where Chinese alchemists came up with black powder, which, of course, would become gunpowder. And as we know, the Chinese were ahead of everybody else in a lot of things that they produced.
Yeah, because, like, fireworks originally came from China.
Right, and rockets. Well, not rockets as we think of them, but if you have a gunpowder and you have some kind of combustible. So, yeah, and it wasn't until... We really didn't know much about Chinese alchemy until like the early 20th century when a man who was a missionary wrote a book called On Chinese Alchemy. He must have translated the Chinese stuff. So yeah, we find that. And then there was a Islamic alchemist named Jabir ibn Hayyan, and he's called Gaber in the West. I think it's that. It's either Gaber or Jaber. It's G-E-B-E-R. That's what Western people refer to him.
Okay.
Now, his goal was what was he called Taquin. And this was the artificial creation of life.
Oh, you know, I'm hearing these different pillars, and I'm like, why have I heard of all of these things before? Right. And it's not just like whether it's in a reading or something. It's like these were actual goals or items that people strive to get.
Right, and he thought you could create life in a laboratory up to and including human life.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're sort of getting into Frankenstein territory.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what time period was this?
This was the early, I'd say, 12th century.
So definitely predating, you know, that era of science fiction, science horror-esque Frankenstein stuff.
Right, right. So, and it's funny because there's so much research on Islamic alchemy because it's the best documented.
Oh, okay.
Because they still have all those translated works that they did, and so many were translated into Arabic, and they had a written record of things. So I think that's what made it. They also brought, and when the knowledge came back to the West, this is when Plato and Aristotle sort of, their worldviews came back into Western science. We'll call it that because... At the time, that's what it was. But even for that time, you know, transmutation wasn't really outside the realm of possibility for how they thought.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we think of it now because we know differently that you can't do it. And
not in the way they're thinking.
Right. And so, but that's sort of a teleological view of that of history, if you will, because... For them, they thought you. I mean, for their worldview, there wasn't anything really odd about it, and that's what sort of led to that. But it was. I also think it was the Jabir's writings that led to the West seeking the Philosopher's Stone because they thought, well, you can get this one thing, and if we can trans, and that's where they learned transmuting from Islamic alchemy, was we can turn this into gold, you know. So. But yeah, so that's how it got to, this would have been about medieval Europe, so about the 10th, 11th centuries. And it's really funny, on a side note, you can actually date when Western alchemy was, or when alchemy was sort of introduced to the West. And I don't know how accurate the date is, but someone actually figured out Friday, February 11th, 1144.
That is an exact date if I have ever heard of one.
And I think
before.
The only reason they have such an exact date because there was a monk, an English monk named Robert of Chester, who completed his translation from Arabic of a book often given the title On the Composition of Alchemy.
Okay.
So he must have wrote a note like when he finished translating it, and that's how they got it. And it's really interesting because if you remember, for a long time, Spain was sort of a Muslim outpost in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where a lot of these guys were going to translate these alchemical texts that were in Arabic, was from Spain. Spain became sort of a translation center, if you will.
Yeah. It's so interesting to me because there are these, we've got these three clear goals, three different regions, whether it's the Philosopher's Stone, the Elixir of Life, or the Creation of Life. And all three of those things I've seen in different plot lines, in different media for so long. And to think that these aren't just, you know, random things that people came up with to make stories, but were part of people's understanding of how the world worked for a time. Because these are, like, you're imagining these things, and nowadays we know that these things aren't real. I mean, as far as we know in our scientific knowledge, someone, you know, thousands of years in the future, maybe they find something and we're like, oh. But they don't have the tools for observation that we have even 100 years ago.
Right.
And these things make sense.
And I think of these things, and I think, well, of course, those, what you had described as these three things, these three pillars, well, yeah, they're going to appeal to people. You know, you appeal to people from their greed if you can turn everything into gold, sort of like Rumpelstiltskin, I guess, and immortality. I mean, who doesn't want that? And so I think it also, that's why I think people were fascinated by these questions. And I know this is a little off track, but not really, and I won't go too far. But, you know, we talk about Frankenstein. I was just having this conversation with somebody this past weekend about the book. I said, the book's fiction, but the whole thing is just a creation of the early, what was going on in early 19th century science.
Yeah.
You know, galvanism, using electricity to give life to things. That was a big thing at the time.
Like these, it seems so silly to us, but these ideas were very real and studied, not in the way we think of studying now, but they were studied, and as you've told by what you found and what books, they were considered real. At least they were at least real or something to strive for.
Right. And what you see when we get to like the Renaissance is you see alchemy breaking off even more into these different avenues. I mean, there was entrepreneurial alchemy. There was, you know, there was pharmaceutical alchemy, which makes sense. There's medical alchemy. But then it also breaks off into sort of occult kind of thinking. And there was a man named Heinrich Agrippa. Now, the problem with some of these names is I don't know if it's their real names or what they wrote under. He was big at fusing like magic and the Kabbalah and all these other things into alchemy.
Okay.
But then there was someone, a guy named Paracelsus, I'm sure it's not his name. And for some reason, I'm forgetting what his real name was, but his name was Paracelsus. He rejected that because he thought, you know, there might be a medical use for some of this stuff, for treating disease. And that's where this sort of Renaissance humanism comes in, because they sort of shifted the focus a little to mankind as an alchemical vessel.
Ah, so this is where this may be, and tell me if I'm wrong, human experimentation becomes a thing from this.
It could. I didn't read much about, there weren't a lot of references to it.
Okay.
But there was something called iatro chemistry, that's I-A-T-R-O, which is actually using, solving medical, you know, using chemicals or minerals to treat medical diseases.
Okay.
And that's kind of what Paracelsus was all about. He was, because he thought if we use these certain things, it might cure people.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking this is where you get things like lead or mercury poisoning, considering those are very common
things. Well, I think I was reading in one, and the book, one of the books I have here is called The Secrets of Alchemy by Lawrence Prinsip. There's no real secrets in it. It's actually a history book. But actually, the author did some of these experiments. He tried them, And some of them worked. Now, they didn't transmute anything into gold, but they did kind of work. They would turn something that was a liquid if you left it into a solid. But, of course, in chemistry, you can do that.
Yeah.
So, but, yeah, so he talks about some of this stuff and using this for – but he also talks about, you know, given the fact that you could have lead poisoning and mercury poison and all this, there weren't a lot of volunteers stepping forward to try these things.
Well, yeah, but then how did this human aspect, I guess, develop further from what you know?
Well, from what you can see is that many people that are sort of founders in the scientific community of things like Isaac Newton, Robert Boyle, Tycho Brahe, I think that's his name, he's an astronomer, were actually alchemists when they started. I mean, they wrote on alchemy. Robert Boyle has Boyle's Law, deals with gases in chemistry, but he had actually written a book that was called Dialogue on the Transmutation and Melioration of Metals in 1680, and it argues in favor of the Philosopher's Stone.
Wow.
So but that occult part of it never kind of left, because there was an alchemist named John Dee, and that's D-E-E. But he sort of followed Agrippa in the occult tradition. But this guy knew a lot of, this guy did a lot of stuff. He was better known for his angel summoning, his divination, and he was actually an astrologer, a cryptographer, and a consultant to Queen Elizabeth I.
Wow.
But his alchemical work was his most popular. Now, what happened here is you have this short-lived, during the 17th century, you have this sort of short-lived, what was called supernatural alchemy. Because some people thought, we can use the Philosopher's Stone to summon and communicate with angels. So now it's kind of going off another track than the scientific track.
Yeah.
Which I think it was always sort of, there was always a risk of that.
Well, yeah, whenever you have some form of thing that's hard to explain, it might go somewhere else, because you can't necessarily defend one way or the other, because no one had, like, there's no no one can prove it works or doesn't work.
Right. So, but later, it's when you really start to get like the scientific revolution, and that where alchemy starts to, it drops a bit.
Yeah, and I'm thinking back to these, you know, these minds of things that we have Boyle's Law, or these minds we hear about when we learn about chemistry.
Right.
That they started with alchemy as their main area, which to me, it's just funny how we think of like, wow, these laws, you know, really at some point it's more like throwing darts at a dartboard, and they got one really good one, and they got one. But how did this translate from this pseudoscience to, well, what we know of chemistry or botany or medicine, things that we actually...
It is interesting because, you know, when I look at this, I always think, well, yeah, that makes sense because, you know, they were doing a lot of things in laboratories like distillation and things and mixing. You know, you can even see it in their... They almost have, like, recipes for what they're doing. And I don't think many people know that Isaac Newton... We always know him as, you know, the Principia and those things he wrote. But I don't think I don't think many people know about his writings about religion and his writings about alchemy. I mean, because he did write that, and he devoted more time to his alchemy than he did to optics or physics or anything of that nature. But what you see is, one example I found was, there was an alchemist, Polish alchemist named Michael Sendivogius, and I'm having trouble with names today for some reason, but he was credited with distilling oxygen in the lab sometime around 1600. Now, the reason this caught my attention, because he taught this technique to Cornelius Drebbel in like 1621, and for our loyal listeners out there, may remember that when we talked about the Revolutionary War submarine, I mentioned Cornelius Drebbel because he allegedly took a submarine down the Thames, and he must have used this as for air, you know. So, but it's funny because there's also a lot of, when we think of alchemy now, there's also a lot of fiction surrounding it. Nicholas Flamel, who was actually a historical person, he was a real person, I looked him up before in our catalog, and there's a bunch of fiction books about him. But and no one really knows why this alchemical tradition kind of grew around him, because he really wasn't an alchemist, but it did. But there's no proof that he ever really was. I don't know. Maybe it's his name. I can't remember if Nicholas Flamel, I think he's mentioned in Harry Potter too.
Okay.
And so, but it's almost natural that these things would come out, because I think eventually what happened with Robert Boyle is he started going in a different direction, and he used more observation for things. And that's why they think that's where it kind of crosses over into chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And so these other ones, yeah. So they, I think that's where you see it. I see it mostly in how they came up with all these, for lack of a better word, potions. And, you know, sometimes you just stumble onto things too. And
yeah.
In Chinese medicine, it was used too. And we talked about immortality,
mm-hmm.
the elixir of immortality. But it also was tied into a lot of Taoist medicine, Chinese medicine. So you see it there too.
Yeah, it's so interesting that the things that the human imagination can create when the observation tools are just, you know, our naked eye, or you give it to a person and they feel better, and you're like, what did this? What did I do? And if you start writing things down and other people start doing it, and then you see different results.
Right.
You know, this is where we get the whole idea of the scientific method, where you have a
right.
repeatable hypothesis, or something that can be redone as an experiment, with an idea that this will be the result. And you do the repeatable experiment, and someone else gets a different result or the same result, and you get more of a consensus that way.
Right.
But when there's... And, you know, this is, I think, where this is me logicking this out. This isn't me, you know, going off the readings. This is where, you know, when you said they started writing things down, like their different formulas, what they mixed and what resulted from that.
Right.
That's where you're getting that consensus of what's there. And maybe that's kind of brings up how chemistry actually became a thing, because enough people start writing things down right. and getting consistent results. Something is going on there, and they know that, but they don't know exactly what that is.
Right, and alchemy is kind of an interesting thing to look at, because it's got all that in it. You know, you almost think of somebody wearing a wizard's hat sitting in a lab, and things are blowing up because they have these potions that will do this or do that. And I can see why it became entrepreneurial,
mm-hmm.
because not only could you, and it was more the elites, of course, that could hire alchemists to work for them. But you say to you, oh, well, I want gold. Let's find this person who can, you know, who can transmute this stuff into gold. Or, I mean, you could even apply it to warfare. I mean, Leonardo da Vinci wasn't an alchemist, of course, but of course he designed stuff for warfare too. And so, but of course with this, you also have a lot of fraud, a lot of what was called alchemical fraud. I like that word, or it's a phrase, but I like alchemical. And so there was a backlash against that too. So Newton kept a lot of his stuff secret, because, you know, sometimes alchemists would use it to counterfeit money. And so it was becoming discredited in some ways because of the fraud. You know, you couldn't turn something into gold.
Yeah, what other examples of fraud were there? Because money is one thing, which you'd expect from something that's, you know, we could transmute gold. We can make something valuable. You'd expect that. But what other things were there?
I think when you had the rise of modern science that came, and I think people started to be sort of suspicious of what they called ancient wisdom. And that was another thing. And so that kind of changed it. But I know in England it started to become illegal, I think, for some of these things to do some of these things, because it got kind of bad. But of course, you know, it's no different than things today. I mean, you go online, go anywhere, you hear kinds of commercials for all kinds of different concoctions to, you know, are your knees bothering you? Well, put this. This is a miracle drug, you know.
Or miracle hair growth.
Yes.
If you don't know, Scott's bald.
So that doesn't really work, folks. I'm just going to throw that out there. But yeah, so I think it's interesting because you had this body of knowledge that kind of it kind of floated through time, and everyone was, you know, there, people were interested in it, and it was helpful in some ways, because from that it sort of slowly evolved into something else. And there was a sort of a revival in the 19th century of alchemy, mostly in the United States. I'm not sure why America, but the two biggest ones were, well, one was English and one was American. It was a woman named Mary Ann Atwood. And then there was a American named Ethan Allen Hitchcock. Now, people will know that name because he was a major general in the Civil War.
Yeah, I was about to say, both of those names, for some reason, I've heard both of those names, but I can't point my finger on when. But
because Civil War. Both of them, even though they wrote separately, they took a completely esoteric view of alchemy. And they saw it more as a spiritual alchemy, which we had talked about previously. And so then it started to receive new attention as an occult science. I think even today, people will look at it. It may be the occult, but I think it still garners interest. Because, I think it's the secrecy that started with it that makes it really fascinating, like how much stuff is out there. And a lot of these alchemists, you didn't really know their real names because they always wrote under different pen names, I guess, if you will. So they could cover up, so you wouldn't know who was doing it. And also, like I said, they wrote within jargon and stuff, so you wouldn't understand it.
So it was like a lot of things with literacy, kept to a portion of society, mm-hmm. I guess. Yeah. It's interesting, as we do more of these, there are some repeating patterns in both how information is kept and then things that are kept purposefully secretive for the general public and used in some way, shape, or form.
Right. It's why you wrote a lot of things in Latin.
Mm-hmm.
And even though so much of the population in Europe was Catholic, they were illiterate. They would go to a mass that was in Latin, but they didn't really know Latin. And so I think that's why a lot of stuff was written in Latin, because there weren't a lot of translators out there.
And similarly to Latin and alchemy, there are things that are, if you read a lot of fantasy, for example, there's a lot of Latin that's used as whether a spell or for what is this ancient thing? A lot of that originates in Latin.
And I had 3 years of Latin in high school. I don't even know if they even teach it anymore. But so when I was watching Harry Potter, the first Harry Potter movie, because I've never read the books, I was laughing because I kept saying, Expecto Patronum. I said, that's Latin. I kept hearing all these words going, that's Latin. You know, and I think that sort of gives it some of that sort of mystery and mystique.
Yeah, I think a lot to it as comes well. From Latin, and then also Nordic mythology as well. Both of those,
which of course we talked about last week with dragons,
which actually, now that I think about it, Nordic mythos has its own kind of pseudo-scientific magic-y area, mm-hmm. with the advent of using runes as some form of thing. And so it's not in the same. It's similar to. It's probably closer to Latin in the how it's a language or a secretive language sort of
mm-hmm.
idea, but that there are these kind of pseudo-scientific things that exist for a particular group mm-hmm. is really a repeating portion that we're going to keep seeing throughout history.
Really. And now alchemy has, for years, it was shunned because it was considered the occult. And a pseudoscience in some ways, or a proto-science. But a lot of historians of science now are starting to look into it because of the things that led to other, from people just sort of mixing things, it led to something else.
Yeah, it's really, at the end of the day, from what I'm understanding of our conversation here about alchemy is really a different form of scientific process, but it usually had the wrong conclusion attached to it.
If you take away some of the more elaborate things like, turning things into gold and living forever.
Yeah.
There is something there. I mean, like I said, the recipes for making things and that just comes straight out of, that's the scientific method in some ways, you know, add this, 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 you know, mix it up.
And then the rest is like human imagination, really.
Yes.
It's a, you know, maybe there is a thing and you talk about it and then other people are like, oh yeah, that's cool.
And like you said, in 1,000 years, some people might be calling the things we're doing pseudoscience.
Right. This is a really interesting overall topic. I feel like this and When Dragons is one of those things that show up across cultures.
Yes.
And I mean, now we have better explanations for both of those, both of these kind of phenomena.
Right.
And it's really interesting, the influence on our literature, how we understand animals and weather and medicine. Both of those, all these are related to each other and developed, but they've developed into something that is scientifically provable or visible with different tools and observations.
So right. And, you know, we talk about how you have it developed in these different parts of the world that don't seem to have any connection to them. Well, of course, it's not because they were influencing each other. It's curiosity. Every culture has that in some ways. And so they were probably just developed this separately because they were looking at these things just on their own.
So just to pique my own curiosity, Scott, what are we thinking about next time?
Well, I don't know. We're really on a roll here with this kind of stuff. And I was wondering, did the ancient Greeks have robots?
No way.
They might have, and I'll talk about that next time.
Oh, hey, Scott, did you know that listeners can actually contact us now?
They can. How can they do that?
Yeah, they can just email us at historycruise@mykpl.info.
Great. Also, like and subscribe on any of the platforms you find this podcast.